As you all know, every generation produces great channels, humans who channel from one of these higher sources, whether it be from the closest spirit domain, your near relative, uncle, somebody, all the way up to the farthest, most reaches that man is capable of reaching. And of course, our great saints are the ones who reach furthest in terms of higher knowledge, laws, intelligence, powers, and so on. And I've gone, to answer your question, gone through, I would say, dozens of these kinds of writings. And when I say dozens, I start out with all the ancient material that I've been able to read from the classical ancient culture of Sumeria and its successor Babylonia, and all the succeeding civilizations that ran through Egypt, the Mayan civilization, the Chinese civilization. And every culture has these writings, as you're talking about. And it doesn't make any difference what you call these people who are a little above the average, whether you call them ascended masters or white brotherhood. In every culture, they have names for these things. Sometimes, let's face it, the names get to be a hang-up. If you're of a Catholic background and you refer to the saints in Catholic culture, you're on safe ground, right? If you go into the Sufi and Muslim culture, you use that kind of idea, it suddenly becomes something different. So words get loaded and maybe overloaded with meaning. But yes, I've gone through all those ancient cultures and tried to find the linking threads. And I suppose it would be presumptuous of me to say that I've come to sift this out and gotten the gold out of the dross, okay? But I'll give you my rough conclusion. I found that in absolutely every ancient culture that I have been able to get original texts, I rarely work from secondary texts. I always try to get the original text because every translation loses something. One of the misfortunes about our Bible, it's gone through so many editions and translations that there's very little correlation between the original manuscripts that have been found and what we read today. You know, scholars keep working and reworking it backward and forward. But I have found that one constant is that every culture that I can trace back always has nine gods as their fountainhead. Many of you who've gone through this know this to be true. This holds true for the Greeks and Egyptians and Sumerians and so on. Number two, constant, is that some being of unusual qualities came to earth and taught the natives everything they know about agriculture and astrology and astronomy and healing and so on. For example, just one example, in the Sumerian legend of their origins, there was a fish called Owanu who came out of the Persian Gulf every day or every night and sat around. It was a fish. He sat around the village at the local pub and taught these primitives how to write and how to breed stock and how to breed plants and so on and so on. This is the foundation of Sumerian culture. You find the same thing in Egyptian with the legend of Horus and so on. Each culture has their own little favorite extraterrestrial being, even though it may come out of the water, who teaches them what it's all about. I mean, this is a constant, okay? So you have a teacher who is not of this earth. And then, of course, he is followed by avatars who are of this earth, and they usually have the same story, the virgin birth, namely the kind of kids I've been talking about. That's what an avatar is. The soul from one of these advanced civilizations who gets implanted on earth with a special body with special powers. And I'm sure that if we knew the full story of Jesus' birth, and if I looked into it in great detail, there's the missing time, and there's very peculiar events, the virginal characteristics, the avatars all have that same hallmark in whatever culture, new world, old world. So that's a constant. And these are people who are sent back to Earth to help. And we, I think, make the mistake of, let's say, worshiping them. We should look upon them as models on which to mold our behavior more than anything else. Anyway, they do the great stunts, they do the healing, they do the teleportation, they wake the dead. And right now on Earth, there are a number of avatars that I've personally seen, and what John has seen, them, and so on. So these are teachers who come back to help. And then number three, and this really should be contemporary, you find a number of different classes of unusual people on Earth. First, the great healers on the planet. And you've all heard of these great healers. And they're always around. The church, Catholic Church, is full of these saints. I can think of at least 20 extraordinary healers that exist on the planet today. What's coming out from these kids? I'm talking about the kids who are a fully developed generation. So they're always on the planet. Now with them come a special group of people, and this is what people you mean by the white brotherhood and all that. These are mediums who act as channels for some higher intelligence and deliver us books. I think the Bible is an example of that, or different parts of it are. We have modern Bibles like the Waspy Bible, the Arantia book, and the list is endless. Now all these are, you have to remember, they're product of some inspired source. Put them down through the brain and the language capacity of the medium. And the great comedian, Bergman, there's very few who can transcend their limitations and deliver straight type skills. For example, I know great mediums who cannot channel mathematical information. They don't know the language. And even if they do it in absolute French and automatic writing, it still doesn't come out clean. So there is a language problem always, and a conceptual problem. So all these Bibles, and I'm just calling them Bibles, that appear all over the planet, you can very easily see, if you study them, the traditional, solid, truth material, and then you can see the local coloring, where they pander to the local taste. And you know the local taste in Persia is different than it is with Eskimos, and with Fiji Islanders and so on, and the Anglo-Saxon approach is different from the Brazilian approach and so on. So the local coloring, you can do this on the planet right now. You can go through the best spiritualist federation, seances in London, and then go to Rio de Janeiro and deal with the same material and come out quite differently because of the local flavor. Okay? No big mystery, just a fact. Now, along with healers and mediums who deliver us Bibles, or I shouldn't say they're Bibles, although Bible just means a book, they're kind of instruction for that day and age, and really are more relevant now than they will be 1,000 years from now, if you look at it carefully. But there are other types of people who are, and I hate to even say this, but they are the real savants. Whether they be religious, savants, you know, learned people, whether they be religious leaders or Merlins of tradition, or whether they're a Nobel Prize winner who just happened to solve a problem that's defeated everybody for 2,000 years. And if you talk to them very seriously, they all come to the same story. Well, they thought about it a lot and couldn't solve it, but in the middle of the night, they suddenly got a vision. The computer was working, they'll say, and they weren't in charge, and the answer came through. There are a lot of stories like that. So in answer to your question, you have this category of phenomena to deal with, and you have a choice. If you're a book type, a scholar type, you study all this stuff and you try to re-edit it and make sense of it. And that's what keeps happening. People keep upgrading and re-editing all the old material. Or you can just decide, I'm going to be one of these people myself and I'll do it again. Now, I may not solve anything, but at least recast the material and make it understandable, acceptable, etc., etc. So you might work in the area of science or literature or in the field of religion somewhere, organized religion, where you bring in a little new light into the edifice of the church, whatever church you happen to belong to. And so you can be a kind of a pioneer and do this anew. And I don't know, I think everybody has to choose their own course, whether you want to spend your life trying to correlate all the material, or whether you try to find it afresh. Because all this stuff is available. I want to make that very clear. It's all out there, you can tap any of it. The big problem is we're like a reducing valve. Only so much material can go through our cup and take a little hit. And I'm the first to admit what a tiny little brain I have and how little one can really absorb in one lifetime. And a lot of people don't feel defeated by the vastness of learning and knowledge and so on. I don't think you should feel that. First, you have to accept that knowledge is infinite. There's never any bottom to anything. You can go on and on and on. Like, all creation has an infinite quality, so learning does, because all the parts of creation add up somehow to infinity, because that's what creation is, the parts and the infinite nature. So anyway, this is a choice everybody has to make for themselves, which way they go. Okay, I'm sorry I took that much time on that question. Yes, anybody else? Yes.
Doctor,
getting back to
the
question on the children, I just would like to know, has the child dematerialized and not returned? And if so, what was the end? The ones that don't return, I don't want to get into too much detail, but usually when we have one of these people in which a child doesn't return, we usually have information that we're given usually through the clock data, okay? One, when the child is to be born, the exact date. Two, where. And the child may be living in one country, I mean the mother and the child, and we are given the exact coordinates, latitude and longitude, where that child is to be born. I know this sounds freaky, but this is part of the process. And it usually is one of the great power centers of the earth where they have to be born. When I say born, they're dematerialized. And this alone is a vast, complicated, interesting subject, which is like a whole week's stuff. The when is given to the exact date, so the mother knows, and she goes to the place, and the child just doesn't come back. Now, that isn't the end of the story, because these children, according to the forecast and the clock, were not born just to feed other civilizations or other living systems. They were born or nurtured in the Earth Mother so that they could have Earth genes, that is, a physical body to work with, and live in an oxygen atmosphere and metabolize the way we have to with food and so on, even though the soul is something else. So I suspect, and we have dates on some of this, and I'm waiting for the first one to return, they will return to Earth and perhaps be the most inconspicuous people on the planet, because unfortunately mankind has an avaricious side. And the mere thought of superior beings coming to Earth freaks them out. They got to get rid of them. They got to stomp them out. And we've had real problems, going a lot of scare tactics, with this kind of attitude. And what we've done is we've parked a lot of our young people who are having these children in a faraway country, in a faraway mountain, where nobody knows where they are, so they're really relatively safe from this kind of damage. But we do expect every one of those children to come back to Earth. But the mothers are the ones that are the most concerned, because they have a terrible love for this child that they've never seen, that they've nurtured. And you know what it means as mothers to have a child disappear. So the big question is, yes, they will come to Earth. Will their mothers get to hold them? And will they know their mothers? Well, I'm sure all this is known. just a question of what will be allowed, and this we don't know. We've not reached that point yet in historical evolution. Does that answer your question, kind of?
Yes.
Are they using the genes of the mother and the father, or some other person on Earth, or where are the genes, or are they developing from?
Okay. Now, the modern teaching of biology says that everything started out as a few atoms, and by certain laws of quantum mechanics, those atoms could get together, and they followed certain possible paths, and the whole tree of life evolved, classical Darwinian story. I think if you take a million species as an example on Earth, if you classify them, yes, you can string them out in an order that goes from the simplest to the most complex, and you say that is evolution. I'm telling you something else, which I was told by particularly Yehovah, that they create every living form de novo. In other words, they have species like this that live in symbiosis. This one produces something that this one has to have, and so on up the line. Now, the big fish eat the little fish. But there's something missing in this symbiosis, in this ecological domain. You say, ha, we need a creature that looks like this. That these little guys way up in the sky, and their spaceships, and the drawing boards, and they manipulate the atoms and the genes, and say, ha. Just like chess master, they say, I think if I move this over here, I'll get ecological balance. So they create this thing, and it's not difficult, because believe me, I have created many living things myself under the microscope, which are things that exist on Earth, but I just created a lot of chemicals and atoms because I have some idea what's going on. So they fill this thing in, and that's so anyway, when they're going to create an evolutionary jump for humanity on Earth, they know what happened the last 6,000 years, where the plan went wrong. They're not perfect, okay? Just remember that, they're not perfect. And not only are they not perfect, but one of the fundamental laws of the universe, much more fundamental than the conservation of energy, is free will. And when you put atoms with living characteristics in them, and then put free will in there, no matter who you were at the drawing board, these things are going to work out their own combination because they have free will. They have these telekinetic powers. They have the connectedness principle, which is a principle in physics called Bell's theorem. All these things are at work. So no creator can, believe it or not, actually predict the outcome, nor does he want to, of any biological aggregate. So, to really answer your question, having learned the mistakes that went into putting humanity together from the last period, about 6,000 years ago, this happens about every 6,000 years, as I mentioned yesterday, they always are like the generals who are fighting the last war, unfortunately. They compensate for all the mistakes made in the past, and therefore evolution just goes on and on and on. You're always cleaning up the mistakes that were put into the last system. And it's very complex, you know. No man on Earth can possibly today understand even the simplest elements of any complex genetic system. There's just too many variables, millions of variables. So they do engineer, they say, and I have good reason to believe this based on the way the children were conceived, as I already described, and the kind of children that are produced and the qualities that are emerging. The people you see in Geller and others in this room who have some of these abilities are just forerunners. They're not the shape of things to come at all. They're just forerunners. They're pretty much, we're all pretty much at a par in that respect. Just a few of these little powers are a little advanced of where we are today, nothing unusual. So the basic law, and I just want to emphasize this point, is control guided bioengineering, not just for this planet, but for every planet in the universe that can sustain some form of life. Yes.
Excuse me, who is the advised of the birth of these children?
Where's what?
Who is advised of the birth of these children?
Who is advised? Well, very simply, I'm advised.
Fine, you're one of them.
I'm just a regular person who came here to be the custodian for this big transfer operation. I'm nobody.
Are there many people like yourself that are advised?
No.
No.
There are only 135 totally new beings who are being created. That would be the entire seed stock. Within those 135 persons are all the genetic potential for the next 6,000 years. And that's not very many people. So one person, okay. I used to sometimes deliver that many kids in a week in a hospital, so it's not much to take care of.
What?
And since you have this...
Can I ask you a question about the 24 civilizations? Because it was just such a question.
Which
we have 24 civilizations.
Oh, all the 24. Oh. That's a long story. I don't want to take too much. They all have names. And the way we... First, let me go. How do we find out these things? One of the principles, because of free will, in dealing with these higher beings, they don't do everything for you, they don't tell you everything. They set up a puzzle, and you have to put the puzzle together, okay? So we did learn that there were a total of 24 civilizations in this little part of the universe that are involved in all these operations that are required to maintain the evolving life. And I did, I guess, although I had a lot of help. Starting in about 1973, I pretty much finished my work with Geller and then turned them over to other people to work with. And I began to, after November 3rd, after they began to appear in the planet in large numbers, I began to pick off certain individuals that I met in my travels all over the world. Who were these new beings on Earth, but all of them were born around 47 or 52, some as late as 56. And you know many of the names that are not quite famous. And I picked the ones that I thought were of special interest, and I studied a total of 72 youngsters. And each one I devoted many months to. And by a number of different techniques, one was simply regressing them by a simple hypnotic technique, but where they remembered everything, it had to be in full consciousness, back essentially through their birth, through any former lives on Earth, back to the parent civilization where they came from, somewhere out in space, and there turned out they were one of the 24. Then I would get the whole story about that particular civilization from them, okay? They were the reporters. Then I would take another youngster, go through the same process, and he might come from the same civilization. So I'd check this story against that story. But that meant the architecture on the planet, the language used, the written form of the language, all kinds of cross-check. So this is how I built up a profile of what the 24 civilizations are, what each one of them does, who their representatives are on Earth. The civilizations have sent now a total of about 1 million people to Earth. A little more than that. And I obviously could never cover those in a lifetime, so I only deal with those that come across my path. Usually I'm on radio or television, somebody calls in, and I size them up, and if I think they're interesting, I do a preliminary study of what their capabilities, how sincere they are, how dedicated they are to their mission, and I usually arrange for them to come to my laboratory in New York, and I would work with them anywhere from 2 months to 2 years, depending on who they are. Now, I don't want to identify all the civilizations, a long story, it would just get you to be like reading the book of a Waspy or a Urantia. It's very confusing. You know, it takes months and months, even years, to get them all organized. But let me give you an idea of some of the functions they have. For example, there's one civilization, I don't think the name is really important. It has a very simple function on Earth, and that is, here's the Earth, and here's some mountains, and here's some undersea places like this. And their function is to maintain a number of bases, or you would call them cities, under the ocean in certain mountain regions around the earth. Why are these there and how long have they been there? They've been there for thousands and thousands of years. And they are places of refuge where people who are part of these civilizations and who have proven their worth, not everybody makes it, will go to, mostly by teleportation, when the real, and I haven't really gone into the details of the real deluge, the real cataclysm that will come to Earth after these 7 years of tribulation. So that civilization has that function. And they have one of my really good helpers, young man on Earth who has now got a higher degree in architecture, and he's incredibly together and dedicated, beautiful soul. You'd never know him. He's totally anonymous on this planet. I think maybe two or three people know his role. And all he does day and night in his mind, he travels to each of these places. And he has total blueprints that he makes by going there himself of how these places work, where the control valves are, where the air supply is, how you grow food, etc., etc., etc. So he's here on Earth, and there are others with him, in charge of just refuges during this period of cataclysm, because a lot of people are going to survive. Obviously, it's not all going to be wiped out, but that's what they're on Earth for. And so it goes with many other functions, okay? Very sketchy answer, but too big a problem to go into now. Incidentally, I want to ask a question. Is there any water out here? Where?
Have you summarized any of those findings in detail in any
Which one? I don't know if you heard the question out there, but have I published all this information about the civilizations, etc.? I don't know how to answer this, but I'll do it the best I can. I have contracts with three books which describe, this is one of them. I don't know how many pages it is. 500 some odd pages. Each one is a contract with a major publisher. I was paid to do the book. I was solicited to write the book. And each one of those books sits unpublished. And the only people who've read the material, I don't go into all the details, but what I've written is the CIA. And all my books have been banned. You can't buy any of my books. They've always been money makers. So the answer is I can't get it published. I could if I were a hot-headed guy and got mad at these people and started gigantic lawsuits and so on and so on, but I don't like lawsuits, I don't like to go into all these things, but they're just sitting in three different publishers' shelves, okay? So what happens when you speak about the kind of things I'm speaking about? Some people got afraid of all this kind of stuff and decided it is not in the public interest for the public to know about this stuff.
Will they ever allow such things to be released?
I don't know. I could do an underground press and all that business, but... Well, see, if you missed the point, I'm under contract with all these people and they won't break the contract. And the only way I can break it is to go to a court of law and have it broken. And I, one, hate to waste the time. I know what it means to go through a major legal procedure, and I have three of them. I know how much it costs. I don't have that kind of money, and I'm not about to start one of these ridiculous lawsuits and ask for punitive damages and all that stuff. That's the story. I don't know, are most of you Americans, or...
No.
Let me just a moment. I don't know if you're aware of it, but in the United States, we have an actual censorship bureau. It has a name, but nobody knows about it. It's run by the FBI. The FBI has in New York a full-time office of FBI agents who do nothing but, with the cooperation of all the publishers, screen every manuscript that goes through New York, and they have it in other cities too. And I was very fortunate. I found the FBI agent who was in charge of my particular manuscripts. And he is retired, and he is very unhappy that he was asked, as a good loyal citizen, to be a censor of other people's, it's a clear violation of the First Amendment. And that alone could be an explosive issue if I wanted to blow it up. But I don't have, I happen to love working in the laboratory. That's where I spend all my time. And to go out into courts and lawyers and legal fees and publicity is totally against my instincts and nature. Story about where they are.
If you use the bigger chalk, I think they can see a bit on the back. The small chalk rate's kind of light.
Okay.
Sure.
Just excuse me.
Is it possible that anyone like us could do something about that?
Oh.
Or is it possible that other people could do something for you in terms of simply writing letters? In other words, if there were enough letters written by people that know about this, obviously the copies would be in there.
Well, I'm sorry I even brought it up. I don't like this. The whole thing is against my nature. I have a lawyer, and I paid him a lot of money. A lot of money. They put pressure on these publishers. And all the amounts of writing letters and vague threats of damages and reputation. It's not in my nature. I wouldn't even feel good about other people doing it. That's the way it is. If the power. Look, again, I don't want to cry, but I've been burned. I've had my house burned down, as most of you know. All my records of the last 30 years have gone up in smoke. Some of these students from these civilizations were in the building, and to jump out of the window, they're still shaking today. From the whole terror of the thing. And the whole thing was bought for and paid for by the CIA and so on and so on. So I don't want to make too many waves because it's more important for me in this case to do my work, which is very, very pressing and very demanding, as some of you know what I'm doing, rather than get into the whole public polemic and then wind up like Socrates anyway, taking a swig of some juice. I'd rather let sleeping dogs lie. This particular case, let that one lie. I don't want to make too many waves about it. Somebody else has.
I think it's again in a pamphlet. Joseph Hare, then you're going to hear a dog. Was it a convict with a publisher
that answers
so long, you
have the money to. There's a clause in every contract that, and I've published many books, in every contract that gives the reversion rights of the copyright to the author if the publisher hasn't done anything in 2 years. And usually, I think you get an idea that I'm allergic to legal matters. I would sign these contracts in a big hurry, and I never noticed that clause was not in there for 2 years, reversionary rights. And it was always at the discretion of the publisher with no time frame for. There were reasons for all this. It wasn't all stupidity, but I'll give you one example to show you what happened. I did a lot of work for some years on something that most of the American public doesn't know and should know, something called the Soviet ELF signal, the woodpecker signal. And I think I was the first one who discovered 5 years ago that the Soviet signal that reached this country was psychoactive, that is, it would work on your brain. And I outlined all this in a secret memo to the President of the United States and Prime Minister of Canada and so on and so on, and said something should be done about it. And all I got was the muddy end of the stick for even suggesting that the Soviets have technological superiority over the U.S. So anyway, publisher came to me, and because I was on radio and television, spoke about this publicly, came to me and said, "Boy, that's great stuff. We want to sign you on to a book." And so they immediately offered me something for a poor scholar, a lot of money, five figures, a dollar value, and said, "We want this book tomorrow." So I assembled a crew and did it all in 6 months. So I was so rushed from the time I started to the time I finished, and I turned out three volumes, some 1,200 pages in 6 months, which is quite a tour de force. And anyway, the thing went on the shelves immediately. Next thing I heard, scientists, friends of mine, would call me up and say, "Hey, Andre, did you sell out to the CIA?" I said, "No." So I didn't hear that, what?
I'm sorry, if this were the right time for the man that demands we had this information, wouldn't the hierarchy make this possible? So perhaps it is the right time.
Okay, I told you there's free will. The hierarchy, contrary to what you may think, does not manipulate human behavior, except in extraordinarily rare circumstances, like if somebody is going to let loose a bomb in the Soviet Union that's going to cause World War III, they'll mobilize some of their troops on Earth, and it's because of our human consent that we go ahead and do it, having been alerted, and with little help, you know, from them, things happen. But that's the kind of extraordinary, they don't interfere. I don't want to break up any of your beliefs, but the hierarchy does not go around manipulating things, because then the whole scheme of evolution, of free will, all that stuff would be meaningless. So they don't really help to overcome. I mean, they're not going to override the CIA, the publisher. If you notice, they let all the ignorance of the world go on. I mean, the really successful people on this planet are not you and I, but they're the mafiosa and the big military-industrial complex and the government workers who have the contracts and can get all the gravy, etc., etc. I mean, the crooks really dominate this world. Let's be realistic about it. We're very tiny little voices in this vast wilderness of overt crime, which you see in the newspapers, and the really great crimes, which, of course, never get publicized. So the obvious answer is that they don't interfere. However, they will not be thwarted either. That's another side of the story. For example, I mentioned just a little bit about the Soviet ELF, extremely low frequency signal. As far as I know, is the first person who found out what they were doing, because I did the experiments and proved that Soviet signal could take over your brain and modify your behavior. Well, now 5 years later, the US Navy has had a super secret, and I'm not part of it, so I can say what I want to, had a super secret research project done to just verify the statements that I made. And they've all been verified, but since they have vast resources and an enormous amount of money, they've been able to prove things which I was not able to prove. They've proved that it deteriorates human memory. They've proved that some of these signals cause cancer, absolutely proven in laboratory animals, and a few other things that are a little too scary to talk about. So in a way, the seed I cast was brought to fruition by other people, and the government now knows. Now they're in a horrible position of how are they going to let the public know that the Soviet signal, which is on the air 24 hours a day and is slowly eroding away people's minds and their reactions and so on, how are they going to let the people know? Well, they did a number of things. First, they set up a massive program, which nobody knows about, to develop the same thing that the Soviets did, huge towers. We're building them in Australia, New Zealand, and the Antarctic to counter the Soviet towers, which are scattered all over the Soviet Union. That's one thing. The second thing is, and this is a horrible thing, is nobody has been able to devise a defense against this signal. There's nobody in this room that's immune from the effects of this signal. And the U.S. government is so embarrassed that with the billions they're asking every year for defense, they cannot defend us against a clear and present weapon which is going on continuously. And the only way they can defend us is to go over there and bomb all these installations and start World War III. So the dilemma is incredible. And there are only a few people like myself and our group in Ottawa, Canada, Planetary Association for Clean Energy, who are able to talk about this and publish. I don't know why they haven't shut us up in Canada. little bit of a mystery there, but nevertheless, we do have a voice. But who reads this little journal? You know, 2,000 copies go out every few months, so we have no voice. But the main thing is the government is fully aware of this, our government, the U.S. government, and of course they alert the Canadians and the British and the French and Germans and all their allies about it. They're clearly aware now that there is a danger, and they're at the verge of letting the public know, but they don't know how to do it. They're leaking it out in little bits and pieces. I was at a meeting in Ottawa at the Learned Societies just 2 months ago, and they got Eldon Byrd, who's a public figure, who was chief of the biological research on this ELS stuff for the Navy, got up and in about four blurred sentences leaked out what was going on. But nobody realized, unless they were in, what he was saying. So they dropped in little hints, hoping to start a rumor mill, but it isn't working. But the public, I don't want to go on about this, it's not the purpose of our seminar, but what I'd always asked for and tried to get is something very simple. Have the government issue every day, just like you get your news report, what frequency the Soviets are broadcasting that particular day and what the signal is in your area. That immediately tells us who know what goes on, what you could do to counteract the effects of that signal on a daily basis. There are certain things that can be done, most of which I've worked out. If they would do that and let the public in on this very insidious creeping danger that we're all subject to, there's no way to hide from this signal. It'll go through the earth, it'll go through any barrier ever built by man, and we're all subject to it. And we have no idea what's happening to the wheat and corn and babies and little lambs. I mean, the biological effects are enormous. Anyway, that's just one way of telling you the kind of a bind the government is in and how they're not really helping us and all their embarrassment and they're trying to catch up. And it's no different than the UFO cover-up for the last 30 years, you know, same thing. Anybody who's been there, who's watched radar reports, pilot observations, taken pictures of UFOs, seen them on the ground, seen them in the air, knows UFOs are real. The government knows this. They have an enormous file. I know exactly where the file is and who's in charge of it, or all the good contact cases. They dare not tell the public because they think the public can't deal with this information. But they're making a mistake. The public usually reacts long before the bureaucrats do to new situations. Anyway, that's a whole side line. I apologize for getting off on that, but somebody asked a question, so I just had to answer. Yes.
Could you mention about that ship that was supposed to be dematerialized?
I didn't, no. The Philadelphia experiment?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to know about that?
Well, I just want to know what I know is true.
Okay.
For
those of you who don't know the story, in October 1943, the U.S. Navy did an experiment in Philadelphia. And the experiment was super classified. It was right in the middle of World War II, and the big problem was that we were sending supplies, as you all know, to Europe and Russia, and the ships were all being sunk. Not all of them, but too many. And so, a fellow named Nikola Tesla, before he died in January 43, had made several announcements to the press that were covered on a worldwide basis, that he had developed an invention that would protect any country or ship or missile or anything, aircraft, from enemy action. And the problem in general was called target invisibility, that is, there's a target here, but the enemy's radar or whatever cannot see it, and therefore it's not subject to attack. So when Tesla died in January of 43, the FBI raided his quarters, which were in the New Yorker Hotel in New York, and took all his papers, really a room full of secret documents which he not published. And they rapidly went, I know because I met one of the FBI men who was one of the break-in crew. And to prove that he was there, he gave me some copies of Tesla's private papers that they had filched, which the government never saw. But anyway, the government did go through those papers and try to find out what Tesla meant about target invisibility. And as a result of that, the experiment was set up on a ship in the Philadelphia Harbor to see if they could duplicate Tesla's work. And what they did was they had these huge coils called degaussing coils in the ships, and with a high pulse of energy, it was supposed to make the ship invisible. Okay, I'm putting it to you very simply. And the first experiment, as reported by people who were there, but the report didn't really come out till about 20 years later, to a company in Texas called Royal Corporation, first word that leaked out. What happened was that the ship, when the juice was turned on, disappeared from Philadelphia and reappeared in Norfolk Navy Yards, about 300 miles distant down the Delaware Channel, whatever the channel is called. And then the ship came right back in a couple of minutes. And there were some 230 men aboard the ship, and most of them had their brains scrambled, some of them were put into mental institutions and so on. In other words, this was not a very smooth teleportation. And some of the survivors of that, some of the mental health, some of the survivors were the ones who leaked the story and then authors put it together. The story as published is not very complete or detailed because the Navy never released the record. Now, you know that project is still going on today. Target invisibility is one of the top priorities of the U.S. government research for the last 40 years. You heard of the stealth bomber, something that can go through radar and not be seen. Well, it's the same project going on. So that's what the Philadelphia experiment is all about. Now, listen, we're supposed to end about 11, and I kept you here. So your questions were interesting for a full 2 hours and nobody screamed. If you want to, you can take a break for 5 minutes and we can continue because I really haven't told you anything of any real depth. Those who want to go. I thought that in some ways this question and answer period was very productive because I didn't realize all the things that, you know, were concerning you. So maybe since we like have a half hour left, if you'd like to, we can continue to get all these things off your chest that bother you, and then tomorrow we can start some program didactic material on this stuff. So let's just go ahead with the questions, and who's ready with the next one that didn't get a chance to ask the last time? Yes.
I was just wondering if all the people that are interested in their psychic work, that you're doing, why couldn't these people get together and these psychic forces counteract these beings and whatever? I mean, can't these beings be bent on their ways? Could we get information from the galaxies of how to do this?
Okay, the question is, can people get together and counteract the effect of these Soviet ELF signals? We have tried various methods of getting people to counteract this, and to some extent, if you're a trained meditator and can keep your mind absolutely glued on 8 hertz, which is the alpha frequency, you can do it. But the big problem is people get tired, even super masters get tired. And I don't know what your record has been in continued sustained meditation, but most people I know begin to get rubbery after an hour or two, and their mind wanders. And the Soviet signal is a machine that's on 24 hours a day. So temporarily you can do something about it, but to sustain it, no. On the other hand, half the battle is won. If, for example, you get up feeling depressed or have a headache or palpitation, all the symptoms that occur with the signal when it's really focused on you, if you know that that is the cause, that's half the battle, because then you don't blame your husband or your wife or the last cocktail you had or whatever, you know, environmental circumstances we usually blame for these things. Now, the second part of your question, can our higher friends help? Yes, they can, but unfortunately, the method of counteracting the signal is very esoteric. And I'll tell you what it is, but it doesn't do any good, because you've got to get the real energization from higher powers. And what it is the following. You have to place something of copper, gold, and silver, and a quartz crystal, four elements, inside of a copper box, solid copper, like what's called a Faraday cage. It can be this small or it can be big. And you have to leave it overnight for 3 nights in a row. And at night they radiate these articles. I have such articles, and when I get in bad trouble, and sometimes I really get intense beaming, I just put them on and that reflects a signal. But you have to remember what I'm telling you is an alchemical process. Just taking the elements alone is not enough. There are energies that we don't know anything about. You might think of something like neutrinos, which don't even interact with any of these elements, which reflect this signal. Now the signal, the reason the signal is so hard to do anything with, the wavelength is so long. It's something like 200,000 miles. It's 1/4 of 186,000 miles long. And such long wavelength, if you send one through the earth, it'll go through the entire earth to come out the other side without any loss of signal strength. So it doesn't see any matter. That's the nature of these signals. So the answer is positive to both, but again, in a limited context. In the first case, you can't sustain it that long, and even with the help of these little ELF signal generators that people are selling, but they're not very effective. We've tested them. And the other hand, for those who cannot be wiped out or stopped, we have had help. But I can't mass produce it. I mean, that's trouble. And I haven't even, thought of the idea of building a building full of stuff like that and getting a charge and, yeah, it's fine.
I don't know, I got this feeling to say it, but don't drink water.
Don't do what?
Don't drink water.
Water.
Don't they want to help?
No, don't drink water.
Don't drink water.
Don't drink water.
Don't drink water. I got that feeling to say it, as if by not drinking water,
it
won't help or something.
I see. Well, yeah, that's the general idea. I suppose I just as well say this. The 7 years that I've talked about are going to be extreme to the extent that a lot of us will leave this earth plane as a result of all the things that are being released. They're here right now. We're just still in that last moment of sunshine where before the clouds move in, and I mentioned some of the things yesterday. So it may be that in some satanic way, and I hate to use this, but there is a war of light and dark forces here at work. And that's almost a misnomer, because that's really cast in earth terms. It's like the good guys and the bad guys. It's the balance of forces that maintain the universe. One is plus and one is minus. And their job is to always maintain balance. So if the good forces are in the ascendant, the bad forces have got to counterbalance it by becoming more active. So in the present situation, it may be that the Soviets have somehow gotten under the influence of the negative forces and gone ahead with this technology, which is not new, incidentally. This technology was discovered in 1900 by our old friend Nikola Tesla, and that's all they're using. But the Western world ignored the findings of this man, and it took the Soviets to recognize what he had done and to recast it in up-to-date technology and conceive of it as a weapon. Actually, I might say on behalf of the Soviets, they're not all as bad as they sound, because what they started out to do, as near as intelligence can tell us, they wanted to modify the weather, because the Soviet Union is not going to fall because of lack of military power or the disorganization of essentially a police state. It's going to fall because they can't produce enough food for their people. And they can't do this not because the communist system is that inefficient, but because the weather has been changing. For example, the temperature of the Arctic Sea There's drought, which influences all of the climate of Russia. It's dropped 2.8 degrees centigrade since 1930. And for every degree centigrade drop in temperature, the Arctic Sea, their growing season is shortened by 1 week. You can see what they're up against. And they normally operate very much like Canada does, with a plus or minus of like 11 days between a good crop and a bad crop. They had some idea, which is essentially correct, that they could manipulate the weather by these waves, because it's known that the magnetic waves influence the barometric pressure. That was all discovered by Canadian researchers. And so they figured by manipulating the magnetic field of the Earth, they could manipulate the barometric pressure and thereby guide the jet stream and get good weather. Unfortunately, as you probably know, the whole scheme backfired, and Soviet Union's had the worst weather they've had. They've had three crop failures in a row, as you all know. They're desperate. They need like 20 million metric tons of grain from the West to survive. And if we're really at war with the Soviet Union, we're not doing much in the war because we're keeping them going with the grain. So the whole thing is a crazy paradox. But that's what they started out to do, and they still haven't controlled it. But in the course of it, they found out what Tesla had already discovered. They could trigger earthquakes with it, and that's why 76 and 77 was such a bad year for earthquake, an all-time record. And millions of people's lives were lost, particularly in the big Tangshan earthquake in China, which some of you may not even recall, but in August of 77, there was the biggest earthquake that we've had in recorded history. Over a million people, at least, were killed. So then they learned, of course, in working around it, that it did have psychoactive effects, and they began to explore that, and all the early experiments were done in Canada, which is where I first picked them up, because I was working for the Canadian government at the time. And the experiments proved to be remarkably successful on their target towns, which was Timmins, Ontario, and Ottawa, particularly, where most of the bad effects were. So once they learned the psychoactive part, they went ahead, and right now they're beaming, you're not aware of it here, but the Washington area, actually the whole eastern corridor from Boston, New York, Washington, and sweeping all the way around to Brownsville, Texas has been intensely bombarded the last 4 months. And our government is well aware of that, and they're doing everything possible to protect the people who make the decisions. But I'm afraid from the results we see coming out, they're not doing such a good job. And we live in that area, so we're very kind. I monitor those signals every day. Anyway, that's where the Soviets are with their experiments now. And I just want to make it clear to you that there are three frequencies that are psychoactive. One is around 8.0 hertz. Hertz means cycles per second. The other one is 10.80. And the one down here is about 6.66 to 6.7, somewhere in that region. This one depresses people. This one makes you feel very good. This is like high meditation. And this one throws people into riotous behavior. The big New York blackout and riot was caused by this signal. The one is July of 77. The Soviets have never, in the last, 7 years now, 6 years since they went on the air, July 4th, 1976, they've never once used this signal. That one makes you feel good. They're not interested in that. And this data is very reliable because the International Amateur Radio Union monitors these signals from the Soviet Union. You get a complete printout every month of their signal activity in different parts of the Earth that's monitored by ham radio operators. So anyway, that's what we're dealing with. And, I don't know, maybe this has some significance to some people. It just happens to be a number. But you see, maybe that's the beast that's been released and we don't even know. And you're supposed to have a mark on your forehead. And maybe it's the EEG signal they're talking about. I don't know, that's speculation. Yes?
Do you think it's power cut
later? What?
I mean, if they're hitting the East Coast, do you think the signal is attenuated by the time it came here?
No attenuation.
Really? In other words, as far as Mississippi or something, you put it in? Well, the problem is your thing is focused on a particular area.
Oh, well, that's a different question. Technically, if this is the Earth, and here's the Soviet Union, and it's got a broadcasting tower there, and the United States, let's say Buffalo is about here on the globe, maybe a little higher. What happens is that the signal from the Soviet Union does not go around the Earth, it goes through the Earth like this, and bounces back at a certain angle, and then there's a great circle, standing wave set up here around the Earth. And when they beam any area, this is what you feel, and this signal here is about 36 to 42 miles wide. So this is the peak signal strength around this great circle route, and all the other places you can pick up the signal, but the psychoactive part is here. And then the shift is around, they have 7 transmitters, you know, the Soviet Union is a pretty big country, so they can tip the axis of this and hit other parts of the world. Most of their experiments have been done changing the axis of this great circle route to hit areas of the Earth where they're earthquake prone. Like the first big experiment was on China, where if this is the Himalayas here, for example,